Have you ever wondered what Amsterdam is all about? Don't just read about the culture that has accepted cannabis. Experience it firsthand with CS Travel's Sensible Amsterdam Tour with Normal. Travel to one of Europe's most beautiful cities this January for an educational and recreational visit to a city that regulates cannabis like alcohol. CS Travel has arranged an exclusive visit for reform-minded Americans that includes a private tour of some of Amsterdam's most renowned coffee shops, educational seminars with coffee shop proprietors, local law enforcement, members of the Cannabis Retailers Association, and Normal staff. Entertainment includes a special evening at the Boom Chicago Comedy Club, canal tours, visits to the city's many museums, including the world-famous Van Gogh Museum. Don't just wonder about Amsterdam, experience the beauty and freedom of this unique city firsthand with CS Travel and Normal Sensible Amsterdam Tour. Pricing information is available online at coffeeshoptravel.com. That's coffeeshoptravel.com. Or call toll-free at 800-816-1846. That's 800-816-1846. Be a sensible American. Visit Amsterdam with CS Travel and Normal this January. Call 1-800-816-1846 right now to book your trip. More information is available at normal.org. Distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. This is your daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular audio podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about the show at our website, normalaudiostash.com. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. Welcome back to Normal's Daily Audio Stash. Today, it's Wednesday, October 24th. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Take a moment to join us at Normal right now to help end marijuana prohibition in America. Just visit NORML.org to make your donation or join Normal today. We have another great audio stash for you today. We're going to start things off with a news special from Boston, Massachusetts. Keith Strub, Normal's founder, was up there today in his first court appearance regarding his arrest at the Boston Freedom Rally for smoking a joint with High Times associate publisher Rick Cusick. They appeared in court today. We'll get a chance to check in with Keith and his attorney in the case, Steve Epstein from Massachusetts. Also, we get a chance to check in with Dr. Keith Saunders, the director of MassCan Normal. They're lobbying the Massachusetts legislature today there at the State House regarding four separate decriminalization and medical marijuana bills. So all that here today in our news special coming up first. After that, we're going to speak with Dr. Mitch Earlywine in our weekly cannabis science segment. Mitch and I discuss a brand new article published in the journal Nature. This article covers a broad range of topics regarding the medical uses of cannabis, cannabis science, the cannabinoid receptor system, but also talks about the legislative and political debate regarding cannabis in our societies. Very interesting article. That's up today in our cannabis science segment. Let's open things up with our news special today from Boston. In our news special today, we're going to speak with Keith Strupp from Boston, Massachusetts. We'll also get a chance to speak with criminal defense attorney Steve Epstein there and Dr. Keith Saunders, the executive director of MassCan Normal. On September 15th of this year, at the annual Boston Freedom Rally on the Boston Common, There were about 60 arrests for marijuana violations at the event, which hosted over 10,000 attendees. Two of those arrests were very high profile, pun slightly intended there. Keith Strop, the founder of Normal, and Rick Cusick, the associate publisher at High Times magazine, were arrested by an undercover Boston police officer while smoking a joint. We covered the arrest here on the Audio Stash and spoke with Rick and Keith just after their release that day. But today, in Boston, Keith and Rick have their first day in court over those arrests. Mask and Normal is also holding a state legislative lobbying day today at the Massachusetts State House. We got a chance to check in with Keith Strupp, his attorney, and Dr. Keith Saunders of Mask and via phone just after 12 noon today to discuss the case and their lobbying efforts. First, let's welcome Keith Strupp. Keith, welcome back to the Audio Stash today.
Hey, always nice to be with you, Chris.
And thank you again for joining us today, Keith. First, tell us how the court appearance went.
Well, it was a routine. It was a procedure that they have here in Boston, in Massachusetts, that not exactly replicated in all other states. But what it is, it's a magistrate's hearing where they try to sort out the cases that they're not prepared to move forward with and dismiss them and separate those out. And then for those they are comfortable moving forward with, they issue an official complaint and give us a date where we have to show up for our arraignment. We met with the magistrate, and he did, in fact, issue the complaint. The arresting officer was there. Sometimes they don't show up. You know, sometimes they decide not to pursue the charge. I think in this case, frankly, with a third of a joint at issue, I doubt seriously they would have pursued it, except that I suspect when they read in the press that it was the founder of Normal and the publisher of High Times magazine, it probably made it more of interest to them than it would have otherwise been. So, nothing much happened. We were not asked to enter a plea or anything, and of course we would have entered not guilty if they would have asked us. But we now have a court date of November 7th for our arraignment, when we are supposed to be back up in Boston for the next hearing. Our step, by the way, now is that we will go ahead and form a defense team. we've got a number of good Normal lawyers here in Massachusetts, and I think many of them would be only happy to serve on the defense team. And so our goal will be to see if we can put marijuana prohibition on trial in Massachusetts. Obviously, there's not a hell of a lot at risk here. A third of a joint, nobody's going to go to jail, neither Rick nor myself. So it really is just a matter of if the state of Massachusetts insists on spending several thousand dollars to try us for a third of a joint of marijuana, well, that gives us an occasion to hold a hearing on the constitutionality of their current marijuana laws. And that is precisely what we expect we'll do over the coming months.
And this has turned into a lobbying day there at the State House. Tell us about what's going on there.
I'm walking around right now with the Mascan folks, and in fact both Keith Saunders and Steve Epstein are here, and you may want to speak with them when we're finished. They're going systematically through the State House. And by the way, there was a period in my life back in 1983 to 1986 where I lived in Massachusetts and worked at the State House, so it's sort of familiar to me. It feels very much at home. It's a wonderful old building with a great deal of history, and the Mascan folks are going from office to office leaving information about Mascan and about the need to stop arresting marijuana smokers. The good news is that there are two different decriminalization bills currently pending in the legislature, and there are also two medical use bills currently pending. And there's some feeling that we just might be able to move one of those bills, maybe a couple of those bills this year. So they're not just wasting their time. In other words, there are four different bills that they're registering their support for and letting these elected officials know that there are a lot of people in Massachusetts that do not think marijuana smokers should be treated like criminals.
And what kind of response have you received for these lobbying efforts so far?
Well, whenever you're walking around lobbying like we are today, you end up dealing primarily with their legislative aides because the senators are either on the floor of the Senate or they're out at a meeting someplace. So we haven't dealt with a lot of members, but I will tell you that the staff members are mostly young people. You know, they're people in their 20s and 30s, and frankly, they're delighted to see us when we walk in. I would suspect that three out of four of them are probably true believers. A good number of them, I suspect, are current smokers, and They're delighted to see Mascan Normal working the legislature. Most of the staff would like to see marijuana decriminalized. I think the more important question, of course, is do they have the influence to persuade the people they work for to vote for in favor of our bills and maybe even to co-sponsor our bills. But it's very promising and very optimistic. You can't help but feel optimistic when you walk through the State House and have so many people giving you a signs up.
And, Keith, how important is it to work with these legislative staffers?
In most cases, I don't think you can change state laws legislatively without putting in an enormous amount of time, getting to know the various staff members, getting to know, you know, who's on your side, who has the ear of the senator, which senator may have kids that are of the age where they may be smokers themselves, and therefore, you know, they need to, it's not always a matter of whether they like marijuana smoking. Partly it is a matter of defense. What happens if your son or your daughter gets popped? Are they going to carry a criminal record for the rest of their life? Are they going to be threatened with jail? So I think for a lot of these people, they recognize that whether or not they like marijuana smoking, it's a fact of life. The recent national survey data shows that there's a higher percentage of smokers, I think, in Massachusetts than in any other state in the country. So there's some real support here.
Righto. Well, Keith, many thanks for joining us here today to discuss the happenings there in Boston. Next up, we're going to get attorney Steve Epstein on the line, who represented Rick and Keith in court today. Steve, welcome back to the show. Thanks again for joining us.
Good to be back.
Now, Steve, Keith mentioned that this was a hearing today before a magistrate judge. Tell us a little bit about that procedure.
Well, if you're not arrested for a misdemeanor under Massachusetts law, you're entitled to have a hearing before a clerk magistrate to determine whether there is probable cause for a complaint to issue. And that's the hearing we had today.
If you would, tell us about what happened before the judge there.
Well, they don't pose any questions to the defendant, who has an absolute right to remain silent, nor do they pose any questions to me other than is there anything you would like to say, Mr. Epstein? And I asked the officer a couple of questions concerning how he knew it was a marijuana cigarette, which he didn't answer well, and basically told the clerk magistrate in both instances that, you know, assuming you found probable cause, the only thing would be if Mr. Walsh, Sergeant Walsh, who was the arresting officer, I shouldn't say arresting, the seizing officer, because they weren't arrested, the seizing officer, if he wanted to just have the case sit in limbo for a period of time, and if they stayed out of trouble, and since Sergeant Walsh didn't agree to that, the complaint's issued, which isn't a problem for us. In fact, after Rick had left the room, he was second, the magistrate said to me, well, all your clients had to do was apologize, and I explained to him that the founder of Normal and an editor of High Times are not going to be apologizing.
Indeed, indeed. And that's what makes this sort of a classic social justice case. Here we have Keith and Rick certainly not ashamed or even sorry for their actions, but we have the law coming down on them for those very same actions, so this small arrest could turn into an important case.
We don't know how important it gets until December 7th when I get my first chance to talk to a district attorney and tell him that, you know, A, we're going to want a motion to suppress, and B, we're probably going to challenge the constitutionality of the statute, and there is no doubt in my mind that Mr. Kissick and Mr. Strupp are going to want to go to jury trial if they don't have any dispositive motions. The Commonwealth will end up spending far more money than Keith or Rick are likely to have imposed on them in fines and costs. And so we'll just, it'll be a show trial. We know that. We'll have fun. I don't know what Keith had to say to you, but we're planning on putting together a defense team that will have some of the best and brightest in Massachusetts on it. And see whether we can't get a district court judge to agree with us that the law is unconstitutional.
And does this case with Keith and Rick perhaps have the potential to go further than these local courts, perhaps to the state Supreme Court there?
Oh, I think that if we want to appeal it, it will, because I don't think a district court judge is going to find the law unconstitutional. It's theoretically possible, but we'll have a basis for an appeal and a basis to stay any imposed prison sentence.
Righto.
Well, I shouldn't say prison because it would be a house of correction sentence, but because we're looking only at a 6-month maximum, and the first-time offenders, the judge has to give them probation, or he has to do heavy lifting anyway to explain why he's going to put them in jail.
Righto, Steve. Well, many thanks again for joining us today. And coming up next on the line here at the Boston State House, we're going to speak with Dr. Keith Saunders, the director of MassCAN Normal. Dr. Saunders, welcome here to the Audio Stash today.
It's great to be here, Chris.
Great to speak with you again, Keith. Now, tell us about the bills you're lobbying for today.
Well, what we're doing in Massachusetts, we have two medicinal marijuana bills that we're trying to draw people's representatives and senators' attentions to right now in particular. And those two medicinal marijuana bills would be much like the legislation that has been enacted in Rhode Island and two other New England states, Maine and Vermont, which would allow for a patient who has a written recommendation from their doctor and the approval of their caregivers to use marijuana to produce it and consume it as they need, as they, you know, the doctor says that they see fit. And we also have a couple of decriminalization bills, both of them in the Senate, and what they would do is they would impose a civil fine for the possession of marijuana. The difference between those bills is really in the amount of money that the fine would consist of. One is sets the penalty at $250, and the other sets it at a range between $100 and $500.
And how have you gauged the response so far to these proposed bills?
The response has been fairly positive. Staffers tend to be well within the demographic where they're very familiar with marijuana use, whether they've used it themselves or not. They know people. Obviously, when they were in college, their classmates were doing it. And so they usually have a smile, and they're very glad to talk about it for a brief period there, and they're fairly receptive. Now, whether that will translate into their employers, the senators and the representatives voting in favor is a separate question, but I think that we have the staff support.
And when will the legislature begin considering some of these bills?
Well, the first hearing in the committee that we have is on one of the decriminalization bills, and that is on scheduled for the 5th of November, and the other bills have not yet been scheduled for hearings. We have, in the past year, we had a decriminalization bill that actually went beyond committee. It didn't quite get to the floor for a vote, but at least it was recommended or referred past the committee, so it seems like there is some forward motion happening here.
And if you would, tell us a bit about the legislative process there in Massachusetts.
Well, the way that it works out is that the bills have been filed by representatives and senators. They have been sent to their various committees, and then it's up to the chairs of the committees to decide which bills are going to have hearings. And so they schedule hearings. After they go through the hearing process, the committee can decide to send it then to the House or the Senate, depending upon which chamber the bill was introduced. And if the Speaker of the House or the President of the Senate decides that this is something that should be voted on, they can move it forward, or through a majority vote of the representatives or senators, they can also move forward and then proceed to vote. Pending a successful vote and approval of either one of these measures, it would then end up on our governor's desk for him to either sign or veto.
Now, there have been a number of individual towns who have passed marijuana liberalization measures in Massachusetts, so this issue is certainly not a foreign one to the Massachusetts residents there.
Yes, there are a variety of towns that have made marijuana law enforcement the lowest police priority. It's a patchwork. One of the problems that we have here is that it is so discretionary that as police can choose to arrest people or choose to let them go. For our case here in Boston, we hold the Freedom Rally on the Common, and every year dozens of people get arrested, and this year it was Keith Strupp and Rick Cusick who ended up being among the arrestees. And so we have that happen at our event. Meanwhile, the University of Massachusetts Cannabis Reform Coalition holds their extravaganza on Amherst Town Common, and they have zero arrests. So here you have, point counterpoint exactly in the same state with exactly the same laws. So the arbitrariness is really part of the problem. And I do think there is a real East Coast marijuana culture in the Boston metropolitan area. We're not quite as open and over the top as some of the folks out in the West Coast of Seattle and San Francisco. But according to government data, we have more marijuana users in the Boston area percentage-wise than they have in San Francisco or Seattle. So yes, it's a very popular substance in this area. The public definitely supports us, and we're just hoping that the representatives will catch up to the public's opinion.
Well, Keith, I really want to thank you for taking time out from lobbying there today to speak with us here on the Audio Stash. Dr. Keith Saunders, the director of MassCAN Normal. Keith, thanks again for joining us today.
Oh, it's my pleasure, Chris.
Dr. Keith Saunders there from MassCAN Normal. We also spoke with Normal's founder, Keith Strupp, and his attorney in his case in Massachusetts, Steve Epstein from Boston, Massachusetts. We have more information about MassCAN Normal with links on our website at normalaudiostash.com.
You're listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash.
Next up today, it's time for our weekly Cannabis Science segment with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Wednesday here on the Audio Stash, we get to talk about the science of cannabis with Dr. Mitch Earlywine. Mitch is professor of psychology at the State University of New York. He's author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence, editor of the new book Pot Politics, and he's got a very new book coming out this winter called A Parent's Guide to Marijuana. You can also catch a monthly column by Mitch in High Times magazine. Mitch, welcome back to the show today.
Thanks for having me back, Chris.
Great to speak with you again, as always, this week. Today we're going to discuss a new article published in the journal Nature. That came out last week. The article is entitled, Cannabis, the Mind and Society, the Hash Realities. Even the editors at Nature and the scientists enjoy some double entendres in their headlines, it seems. But this article was a very comprehensive piece that offers the full history of cannabis, the new discoveries regarding the cannabinoid receptor system, and also covers a lot of ground in the political and legislative debate. I know you got a chance to read the paper. What were your initial reactions to the piece?
It's funny, Chris, because I realized my own prejudices can work against me. When I saw Robin Murray had something in Nature Reviews, I thought, oh, great, it's going to be another inflammatory harping on cannabis and schizophrenia or something, when in fact the article itself, although I could certainly point to some things that I perceive as biased, is as even-handed as I have really seen in one of these kinds of journals. And I was particularly struck by the endnote, which is basically the authors go through a reasonable summary of negative consequences of cannabis use and how rare they are and how severe they might be in a very small subset of people, but how generally they aren't particularly troublesome. But then, you know, really do lay out their perceptions of cannabis-inducing mental illness in a small group of people and cannabis-creating dependence in a small group of people. And then I thought, okay, now they're going to gear up for the big let's make sure it stays illegal forever. And in fact, they go quite in another direction and point out that really legislative status has very little impact on cannabis use and cannabis problems, and that public education and, you know, an approach that really makes the risks of excessive use known works a hell of a lot better than tossing folks in jail and arresting 800,000 a year and things like that. And I was just so delighted that here's a guy who clearly sees this literature in a different light from the way I do, but would still come to a comparable conclusion. That gives me a lot of hope.
And is it Murray's own work that has kind of rekindled this cannabis classification debate in the UK?
He has been behind some of the pushes to change the classification, but only very loosely. So his work on this summary of some of the cannabis use and psychosis literature is relatively matter of fact, but unfortunately he does end up repeating some of the things that I think are sort of overstatements about cannabis and psychosis, and the slip from psychosis to schizophrenia as if these two things are equivalent is very quick and often sometimes a little weaselly, if you will. But the fact that he's willing to publish something that basically says that public opinion is more important than legislation on keeping these problems to a minimum really is, you know, a source of optimism.
Now, in the first portion of this article, the authors cover the history of cannabis going back thousands of years. Is it better to look at this whole history rather than focus with sort of microscopic detail on a specific study, do you think?
I think it's better, and I, you know, harped on a lot of this in Understanding Marijuana in the first chapter, that we've really got literally thousands and thousands of years of history with this plant, and the negative consequences still aren't what they're alleged to be. I think he was elegant in pointing out that some of the things that we suspected in the past, both good and bad, have turned out once our research methods have improved. But many of the other things, again, both good and bad about the plant, have not panned out. And I felt like it was neat that the things he chose to emphasize in his timeline on the history of cannabis were not all negative or all positive, but rather matter of fact. Although, of course, the fact that he mentions Normal by name had to warm my heart.
Indeed, the foundation of Normal is noted right on the timeline as an important event in the history of cannabis. On that same timeline, they note that in the 80s, a statement made by a study conducted by the National Institutes of Health that said, quote, "There is no evidence that cannabis causes permanent health damage, affects brain structure, is addictive, or leads to harder drug use," close quote. And the authors of this article in Nature kind of wonder aloud in this piece why such statements by the National Institutes of Health and others in our recent history have not been taken more seriously by legislators.
I think he mentions, too, that there tends to be this kind of polarization among elected officials, and if they have to actually stand up and say, I personally want to decriminalize marijuana or you know, tax and regulate, that can be suicidal. Whereas alternative approaches where we can get, you know, people to just vote on the floor about a legal policy that would alter our current prohibition, then people are more willing to support things. So some of the recent medical marijuana moves, for example, that may not have had an individual governor or person take a lot of risk, particularly during an election, to support. Later on, once they end up on the floor, these things get unanimous or near unanimous support, and I think that that's a sign that people are behind this change, but often aren't willing to quite jump out and take the risk to make it a prominent component in their campaigns.
Also of note in the article, and fascinating to me personally, were these just wonderful diagrams depicting the cannabinoid receptors and how they work. This is a relatively new realm in cannabis science undertaken in the last 15 years, and the diagrams are really the first ones I have seen that so clearly show the inner workings there. Very impressive.
Oh, he did a superb job, and I feel like the opportunity to really get a feel for, you know, what is a neuron like and what's really going on right at the sites where two neurons meet can really help us understand not only how does marijuana work, but what's going on with some of the natural cannabinoids, some of the substances that our body makes automatically that fires these as well, 2-AG and, you know, just basically anatomide, some of the other things that are the source of pleasure and bliss in our lives that don't involve the plant.
Now, some of the article goes to the heart of a presentation you gave at the Normal Conference just a couple of weeks ago, talking about cannabis use and psychosis. They spend a fair amount of time and space on this in the article, and the lead author, Murray, has published on this subject previously. Did he take a different approach here?
I appreciate that he's trying to take a more matter-of-fact tone about the psychosis literature, and he has added one new study that came out of the UK recently that actually didn't have a very big effect as far as cannabis increasing risk for a psychotic outcome. But you'll note when he tables all these results, some of the big drawbacks of all these studies just aren't part of the big picture. So it's unfortunate, but really only one of these studies looked at schizophrenia per se, a diagnosable disorder that has some genuine impairment. Six of these top seven actually didn't require any impairment in order for people to end up in the sort of psychotic group. And these effect sizes are in truth relatively small when you average these out based on, you know, what you would normally expect for, say, you know, the risk of tobacco and lung cancer, you know, something that has a big effect. It's always going to be bigger than 2.0. A lot of these are under 2.0, and the average, not from this, but from that big Lancet meta-analysis, was only 1.4. And the range sometimes goes down close to 1. 1.0 means it's basically the same as anybody else's. And clearly, we don't have enormous effects on some of these things. The other drawback is they, you know, they say, oh, and we controlled for psychosis before the people were actually using cannabis. And in fact, that's not the case in a lot of these studies, in part because a lot of these people were, you know, 11, 12, 13 years old when the study began, and it's very difficult to assess some of these symptoms in folks that age and to know how to really take them seriously. I did like the focus on the COMT gene and that folks who have a special combination of these genes may be the ones who, if in combination with a lot of early use, might be the ones who are raising some of these issues about psychosis. But again, you know, we're talking about really small increases in a disorder that when it's debilitating is relatively uncommon, and in fact is considerably rare.
Now, they do talk about what you aptly have called schizophrenia light, and this is a schizophreniform disorder that may last about 1 month for individuals. So how important is that? I mean, if we looked at schizophreniform disorder and all of the things that those diagnosed with it are consuming, would you be able to say that, you know, chocolate ice cream causes the disorder as well?
Well, the beauty of a lot of these is that they're longitudinal. So at least they're following these folks up later. So there is an opportunity to identify a predictor of a psychotic problem before it actually develops. And some of these, not necessarily chocolate ice cream eating, but some of these correlates are taken out of the effect when they do these analyses. So they'll take out the impact of other drugs in a couple of these studies, and alcohol, which is also, you know, pretty serious problematic trouble for folks with psychotic disorders, and they play those up. But as we've seen in some of the data I presented elsewhere, some of these assessments, not so much in the COMT gene study, but in some of these other ones, are a little bit biased against cannabis users because they ask about things that really involve just a sort of a set of deviant activities or slang or use of words in odd ways. And then some of the other issues just concern me about not these studies, but these studies on schizotypal personality disorder, which is also a sort of schizophrenia light that gets some play. There are 5 studies saying, oh, that this is more common among cannabis users. And in fact, people are doing a really poor job of controlling for other drug use. My student Nicholas Van Damme has just finished a paper showing that once you take out the dopaminergic drugs, drugs like cocaine and methamphetamine that actually are very closely linked to the system that seems to be important in schizophrenia, those effects disappear, and that it's not cannabis that's a correlate so much as cocaine and methamphetamine and amphetamine and things like that.
And the authors also in the paper go through many of the new medical discoveries with cannabis and the cannabinoid receptors. So even though they're talking about the politics and the broad range of topics, it does also seem that this paper does strengthen the argument for medical marijuana.
Oh, and I found it particularly pleasing to see how open this review is to not only just cannabinoid medicine in general, but even smoked cannabis. So it's clear that both the cannabinoid, the CB1 and the CB2 receptor are really important in the way we function. And the CB2 in particular has a really interesting role in immune function that we don't completely understand yet. And we're learning just about the immune system simply because of the discovery of this receptor. And then they're real matter of fact about, you know, here are what the outcome data say, and here are the data that we need to gather. We just don't seem to have the opportunity to make some of the decisions we need to make because we don't have the appropriate research. So we end up using some of these CB1 antagonists or, you know, these other drugs that are loosely related, but it doesn't quite give us the feel that we need to have. And by having more clinical trials in this domain, we'll really be much, much better at making informed decisions about using cannabis as medicine. But the irony is sort of in the back of my mind always is, look, we've got literally thousands and thousands of people who are benefiting from this. Let's not, you know, make them wait until clinical trials are over. We already know that a lot of this is going on. And I feel like in some places the authors here are kind of winking at us saying, look, everybody knows, you know, increased craving for food, improvement in appetite. Come on, let's let these people have their medicine, because I assure you they're not worried about dependence or some minor respiratory irritation.
Now, this isn't the first time a paper on cannabis or even the cannabinoid receptor system has been published in the journal Nature, really one of the most widely read and best known science journals in the world. But how important is it that this paper, which addresses some of the societal implications, is being explored by scientists in this venue of nature?
This is intriguing for me, even on a personal level, because I'm curious if suddenly we'll all be able to publish, you know, cannabis-related research in some of the more prominent journals, when there was a time when those studies ended up kind of in the second and third tier journals more often. But also, I'm hoping that media and policy folks will take this much more seriously. Now, this is a really accessible article. It's got nice illustrations and makes very clear arguments. And then the conclusion is just so compelling that really what we need here is education and not imprisonment. And I'm hoping that a number of, you know, media places will sort of get on this and ask Dr. Murray for interviews and just get more correspondence with him in order to get this big idea out that basically alterations in legislative status don't really have the impact that we want, that informed consumers are the best consumers.
Righto, Mitch. Well, this has been a wonderful discussion here today. I really appreciate you taking time to speak with us about this important new article in the journal Nature.
Happy to help.
Thank you again, Mitch. Dr. Mitch Earlywine is professor of psychology at the State University of New York. He's author of Understanding Marijuana, A New Look at the Scientific Evidence. He's got a new book coming out this winter called A Parent's Guide to Marijuana. And you can catch a monthly column by Mitch in High Times magazine. Dr. Earlywine joins us each Wednesday here on the Audio Stash for our Cannabis Science segment. We have links to his books and articles right up on our website at normalaudiostash.com. Listening to Normal's Daily Audio Stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Make sure you visit our website at normalaudiostash.com. That's normalaudiostash.com for more information about every day's show. I'm your host, Chris Goldstein. Thanks for listening today. See you at 4:20 tomorrow. Podcasting technology of Normal is made possible by Red Aphid Interactive Media. More information at redaphid.com.